From APR, American Public Radio.
Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, C.A. Over the past two decades, CEOs, the chief executive officers who head major corporations, have begun to beat a steady path to Washington. Now they come to testify, to advise, and to learn. And most of all, they come to advance or deflect policies affecting their business interests. Now whether they succeed or fail, their efforts strongly influence political action in America today, and may even contribute to America's position in the world economy of tomorrow. My guest is journalist and author Max Holland. Max, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George.
You know, Max, I'm almost tempted, as a matter of fact, I am tempted to make a kind of an anthropological observation to begin our conversation, because when I thought about it, it occurred to me that the presence of business executives in Washington is almost like a clash of very distinct tribal cultures. Am I onto something? That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Why was that?
Well, because I think the way most corporations operate is in a very hierarchical manner. And I think there's a quote in my book from Harry Truman talking about Dwight Eisenhower becoming president. And he said something upon Eisenhower taking office, per Ike, he's going to give an order and he's going to think something's going to happen, like in the army, but it's not. And that's the nature of Washington is very different than the nature of most corporate cultures, where if the CEO says something, ought to happen the next day, it does happen, and someone's accountable for it.
Right. You make it sound to me as though a CEO's corporate culture is decision-oriented, and Washington may be a place more concerned with process, or at least more subject to process.
It's more subject to process, and it's a place where interests clash, and compromise is basically the name of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And fundamental change can occur, but it occurs often incrementally, or it only occurs after a lot of groundwork and preparation. And those are things that don't happen in most corporations.
You know, your book, The CEO Goes to Washington, Max, which is a series of case studies of how different corporate executives have operated in this arena, covers a lot of this ground. One of the things that I'm wondering is, have corporate executives as a group gotten more savvy about this Washington style of things? In other words, I guess I'm thinking that perhaps, at least in historically, they might have been somewhat frustrated by this kind of, what they must have considered constant dithering. Have they adapted to it?
I think very much so. Probably the Business Roundtable, which it was formed in the mid-70s, is probably the epitome of high CEO involvement. This was an organization formed to bring the opinions and views of top corporations directly to policymakers. But even aside from that organization, individual CEOs are much more active now than they ever were for a variety of reasons. And one is there's more competition now in the marketplace, and Washington therefore affects a corporation's fortunes for good and ill.
Has the global economy affected this too, the fact that they have to compete much more intensely internationally?
Correct. That's probably the major reason overall why more CEOs beat a path to Washington. But in some industries, like the utility industry, which is heavily regulated, you know, they've been active here through Washington representatives for decades. So it kind of depends on industry by industry. But if you take the one example that I use is Lee Iacocca, when he came here and won money for Chrysler from the Carter administration, or a loan guarantee for Chrysler. That really showed CEOs that, you know, one CEO can make a big difference. Mm. And especially because Iacocca became an overnight celebrity practically after that effort, after his book. His book went on to become a bestseller.
Right. We're going to talk about CEOs that have made a big difference in different ways. And I think this is one of the most important points of the book, that they come for different purposes and either accomplish or fail to accomplish those purposes. And sometimes, and this I thought was very striking, they are concerned with larger issues and issues that we might not immediately associate them with thinking about. I mean, let me take, to start this part of our conversation, one example that I found very striking. And I can use the person of John Young, who's the chief executive officer of Hewlett-Packard, and as you do in the book, to sort of to frame it. He's concerned, and clearly very sincerely and very profoundly, with the issue of competitiveness. Now, I think you'd help us very much, Max, if you would tell us, first of all, why this is a major concern of his and how he came to sort of pronounce it in the Washington arena and began to work on it. What's the tie there?
Well, he's an engineer by training. He spent most of his working life, all of his working life at Hewlett-Packard, which he joined in the late 50s. Hewlett-Packard is the original high-tech Silicon Valley startup. It really defined that kind of company. It was started in the late 30s by Hewlett and Packard. And Young is a person who always believed that manufacturing mattered in the United States, that production is the engine of economic growth, and that the service industry, you know, was driven largely by the needs of production. So he never bought the idea that was popular for a time during the Reagan administration, that the move to a service economy was natural and desirable. And he's an example of a CEO who, by the force of his personality and perseverance, has really helped. I wouldn't say it's been a one-man show, but he's really been the star of this idea that the United States economy was becoming less competitive in the world marketplace.
Now, isn't it an American president, I'm not sure whether it's Reagan or Bush, that actually gives him a position and a sort of an official position,
right,
in terms of the American government's concern with competitiveness?
Right. After the 81-82 recession, it wasn't clear how manufacturing would be much of a political issue in the 84 campaign, but the Republicans were worried, and so they formed a commission, and they appointed Young, who they felt, because he came from Silicon Valley, which is sort of the free market ideal, according to the Republicans, that he
would... And he's
a
Republican himself, is he not?
And most CEOs are. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say he was a highly partisan Republican, but he believed more in basically Republican policies. So they appointed Young, and I think they felt that was a safe appointment because he would come out with recommendations that would be palatable, to say the least, to the Republican administration. What was surprising, I mean, there's a parallel in the education report that was produced, A Nation at Risk, during the Reagan administration. What was surprising, and the report was delivered after the 84 election rather than before, was how strong the report came out against Reaganomics. Hmm. Basically, the idea of Reaganomics was, the free market takes care of everything and it's government's business to get out of the way. And Young turned that basically on its head. He said, we're lacking an industrial policy, and that you have one by default, whether it's conscious or not. And we have the worst one because it's unconscious, disorganized. And what we need more than anything is an overall government strategy, government participation with the business sector to make America competitive. And that ran directly counter to the Reagan ideology, plus their attempt to cut back government involvement in the economy.
So it didn't get much sympathy or support, or much less enactment.
That would be an understatement.
Is it the kind of thing that he kept up beyond that particular tenure with the government?
Right. Well, about after a year, Alexander Trowbridge, who was head of the National Association of Manufacturers, visited Young and said, this is in 85 now, that the situation's only getting worse. When everyone thinks about this issue, they think about you. You've got to do something more. And so then Young went on to found, with other leaders from academia and business sector and unions, an organization called the Council on Competitiveness, which was this new player in the Washington think tank arena. And, Washington is nothing if not full of these kinds of organizations. But this one has made a real difference.
Has it made a real difference in terms of public opinion? Has it advanced the cause, the issue of competitiveness among the population at large?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that, of course, there was the conditions for making the issue resound among the people, but they were the ones, as much as any group, that made competitiveness a buzzword, and probably, along with the natural economic cycle, was the pivotal issue of the 92 election. And you found Young, a lifelong Republican, along with about 28 other CEOs from high-tech companies, endorsing Clinton. And whenever you have a split in the business community away from the Republican candidate, you can safely say that the Democrats have it very well. And that happened in 32 and in 64, and both times a Democrat got elected.
Well, if we take 32 as the analogy, and we take what seems to be a rapprochement between Mr. Young and the group he represents in industry and his contact with perhaps persuasion on the Clinton administration, what's the net effect right now of that on the Democratic Party? Is the Democratic Party, which is of course the party now in executive power, shifted substantially in terms of its relations to the business world, substantially and
I think it's everyone recognizes that the Clinton administration is considered a very pro-business administration. I mean, they make no bones about it. If you ask McLaurity or Ron Brown, they make it clear they believe government has a role to play in nurturing and making the proper environment for investment, but I don't like this word, but in a proactive way, especially, you know, in a state like California, which has lived by the Cold War, the defense spending, and now is having probably, along with Connecticut and some other high defense spending states, the biggest readjustment.
The CEOs in your book, Max, come to Washington for different reasons, and I'd like to turn us to one that I found particularly intriguing, because if I was going to use a cliche, and I will, it sort of makes the case that you can fight City Hall, or at least fight the government on occasion and win. And this is the case of Rene Anselmo, who's a very interesting figure. He strikes me as something of almost the archetypical entrepreneur, the kind of man who invents something and makes it work and then wants to advance it. In his case, it's satellite communications that he's concerned with. And his particular fight, the fight he has against government, is that it's a government monopoly that he's fighting against, and he wants to open it up for private competition. He does this, and he does it through something much more than persistence. Persistence is a big part, but tell us what makes this work, what makes this campaign of his work.
Well, the analogy here would be William McGowan and AT&T. William McGowan is the CEO who founded MCI, which is now a multi-billion dollar company, direct competition with AT&T. The difference is AT&T was a private company with a government-sanctioned monopoly. Anselmo's fighting a government-created monopoly in the form of a quasi-government private group called ComSat, which was created in 62 when satellite communications were in their infancy. ComSat's an American participant in an international consortia called Intelsat. And at the time, satellites were very expensive to put up, and it didn't really make any sense to have private companies competing. So at the time, in 62, it made sense for this government-created monopoly situation. But as in a lot of things, there's been, you know, great technological advancements, and Anselmo wants to compete with this government monopoly. And so he has spent the last 5 or 6 years fighting tooth and nail to get, you know, ComSat's advantages whittled down so that he can compete on a fair, even playing field.
Was one of the government reasons or one of their positions that there was a security dimension in this and they had to control it as a monopoly and they couldn't allow for Mr. Anselmo or others to?
Right. There's a the government monitors satellite communications through the National Security Agency, and there was some concern if you had this proliferation of private systems, it would impede the government's ability to do that. But he was quite willing to meet with the government and satisfy any legitimate concerns they had. His problem was in finding out what those concerns were, because ComSat's very highly linked with the government. You have people like Melvin Laird on the board. You had Dean Birch, who has since died, but he was a former FCC commissioner, very close to George Bush and the Republican Party. And Anselmo had a lot of difficulty in overcoming these vested interests and alliances.
Well, in addition to his persistence in trying to overcome those alliances, he used a lot of wit. I mean, at one point, he used cartoons to sort of focus public attention on.
Right. He took out a large cartoon in the New York Times to illustrate his troubles. What happened is he had put this proposal before the FCC, and then suddenly it went into this black hole of national security considerations, and it was virtually impossible for him to get a meeting with a federal official to tell him exactly what those considerations were. And that's probably the worst situation to be in Washington. You don't know the interests, you know the interests arrayed against you, but you don't know what the arguments are. And the way things usually work in Washington is you present your arguments, the other side presents its, you counter theirs, they counter yours, and the best idea wins out. But he wasn't really allowed to know, and his lobbyists really couldn't find out what the arguments were. So he took out this cartoon after one particularly frustrating meeting down here in Washington, poking fun. And it got the desired effect because everyone started talking about his delayed petition.
One of the advantages of your book, Max, I think, is that you personalize these issues. In other words, they're case studies, but they revolve around what individuals do. And in the sense that a book also belongs to the reader, here are some of the things that occurred to me as I read about Mr. Anselmo. I call them the five qualities that I think he exemplified in doing what he did, and you tell me whether I got it right or all wrong. But this man, this very dynamic figure, as you point out, comes down to Washington, and Mr. Anselmo goes to Washington, and he wins. And I think it owes to these qualities. First, direct action. He got in there. Expert counsel. He must have been well assisted in terms of research and legal backup.
Yes.
Constant effort, because you just can't be deterred. You will be deterred easily if you allow yourself to be. Fourth, political allies. It seems to me you want to, in some sense, make your case larger than yourself to the greatest extent you
can.
That's
absolutely necessary.
Yeah. And then finally, and maybe it's not true in every case, but where it is true, public opinion, getting the public stirred up about what you're stirred up about.
Right. He had a lot of allies in the private sector, broadcast companies, overseas telephone companies. And, I mean, the public comment in his case was overwhelmingly in favor of his point of view. I think it was 98-2, the two being a company that made satellites for CompSat and CompSat.
So these then are pretty much the qualities, you think, that
absolutely
that make these things successful?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've got some more cases to look at that are equally fascinating. Before doing that, though, let me just say that this is Dialogue. I'm George Liston, C.A., and my guest today is Max Holland, contributing editor of the Wilson Quarterly and The Nation. Max is a former fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center. His most recent book is The CEO Goes to Washington, which was published by Whittle Books. Max, I want to turn now to a considerably more controversial issue, and one which in the minds of many people sums up a decade, an era, a recent one that we've lived through, a business maneuver, if you will, the leveraged buyout, or LBO. And it points up, and you, of course, have this in your book, in the case and the figure of Mr. Henry Kravis, who was very successful at this. But I think one of the main points that's made by a study of leveraged buyouts and Mr. Kravis as an executive working in Washington is that there's also an interest in making things not happen as well as happen.
I think the American public's perception of businessmen coming to Washington is they want a tax break, some sweetheart favor, a government contract, some favorable regulatory ruling, and that's all true. But it's also true that lots of times, or a fair percentage of the time, business comes here to block things. They don't want things to happen. They like the situation perfectly well, and they don't want the regulatory agencies or the Congress interfering. And that was the case with Kravis.
Explain to us why that was the case and what he wanted to keep from happening.
Well, basically, leverage buyouts existed because of several reasons, but in terms of the government's role, the tax treatment of corporate debt was the single most important finger in the dike. If you change the tax treatment of corporate debt, he changed the ground rules and made it far less profitable. So his singular purpose was to protect the way corporate debt was treated, which is that it was you could totally apply it against your income.
And that the essential point here, Max, is it not, is that no matter what kind of debt it was.
Right. The essential point is that when the government passed that, conception was if you invest in new plant and equipment, you should be allowed to deduct that from your income. But what Kravis and others, he wasn't the only one, saw was that corporate indebtedness, which you could create to take over the corporation, could also be subtracted from the income. And that's how he captured control of corporations ranging from Safeway to RJR Nabisco to scores of smaller ones.
I guess the key question at this point is, was Mr. Kravis successful? He wanted to keep things as they were so he could presumably keep on doing this.
Well, you'd have to say overall he was successful because for most of the 80s he got his way, so to speak. I mean, there was one congressman, one lonely voice in the House, Byron Dorgan, who kept wanting to change the rules for deducting corporate indebtedness, and he was beaten back, and almost nothing existed in the Senate, pretty much. The one time Dorgan succeeded nearly in changing the rules, there was this sudden reaction on Wall Street. The market crashed in 87, and suddenly the Democrats were cowed from attacking this issue, and the Reagan administration thought, of course, it was all fine. So basically, you'd have to say Kravis was successful. The one time he was a little less successful was after 89, and the RJR Nabisco buyout became controversial. And then Congress took another look at these leveraged transactions, and it did cut back on the ability of corporations to deduct not real interest payments, but obligations that they were undertaking. So, and that was even a more Baroque kind of speculative deduction.
I think more than any other case in your book, Max, this, the case of Kravis and the LBOs, has for me the sense of a morality tale.
Mm-hmm.
And on that assumption, I'd love to ask you, I can't think of anyone better, what's the moral of the tale?
Well, I think it's sad to say, but I think in this country we've had a move towards, as long as it isn't illegal, it's okay to do. There's a real lack of ethics, as exemplified by this leverage buyout phenomena. I think it starts really at the top. You know, there was been a great suspicion of government dating back to the 60s because of people's view that the government lied about certain things, especially during the administration of Richard Nixon. And that sort of seeped through, and in our elite professions, lawyers and investment bankers, it was also a different generation, there came to the notion that it, as long as it wasn't illegal, it was okay to do.
Hmm.
There was a decline in ethics.
And probably a rise in cynicism then.
A rise in a company, or part and parcel of a rise in cynicism.
Yeah.
And you have a lot of things happen that an early generation would have looked askance at, as Jerome Kohlberg, Kravis's own partner, eventually did. I mean, he felt he had sort of created a Frankenstein after a while, because a lot of the carefully drawn principles that he thought existed, such as you do these things only in concert with the management of the corporation, started to erode because the lucrativeness of these deals became so powerful.
Right. Without wanting to appear cynical myself, I want to ask you a question about this whole phenomenon of the business executive coming to Washington time after time again, issue after issue again, case after case again. To put it very simplistically, what prevails, Max, logic or money in these situations? Or can you, or can one even
well,
judge
I think,
it that way?
I don't think money always prevails. I mean, Comsat had much bigger resources than Rene Anselmo, and yet he's prevailed. Kravis has prevailed because he was able, through large campaign donations, I think, to make his voice heard very effectively. And his natural opponents, let's say the union movements, were during the 80s consumed with other issues, declining union membership, and they weren't able to mount the opposition that they once might have. But I don't think money always wins. I think the public perception that that's all that counts here is wrong. Information is the currency in Washington, and money can buy you preferred access for your information that you want to get to people, but it doesn't always win the day. You have to have logic of certain arguments on your side, ultimately.
I think your answer is eloquent, and you remind me that in your book, your concluding case study pretty much makes that case, in that there's almost a transformation of the utilities industry, is there not, through the efforts of one executive, Mr. McCormick, and his use of logic, very doggedly, I thought.
Right. He was a very controversial CEO back in Michigan, but his argument here did prevail because he was, and his lobbyists were considered a reliable source of information.
To conclude our conversation, Max, I want to go back into the other writings of Max Holland, and in this sense, because throughout my familiarity with your writings and your person and your arguments, I've noted, and I think it's quite obvious, a very strong sense of the public interest and concern about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I move to ask you, what is the public interest here? I mean, we've been talking about individuals coming down representing interests as they're supposed to do, and there's no problem there. But is there a larger public interest that we all should be aware of, and a responsibility that we have to kind of relate to this process?
Well, I think the founding fathers set up a system where, you know, Washington would receive a lot of competing interests, and then it would choose among them. And I think it's fair to say that all voices ought to be heard. I mean, Henry Kravis's as well, because, you know, as I said, there is a kernel of truth, from my point of view, in the argument that corporations needed to be subject to certain outside forces. So I think everyone ought to be heard, and that includes the business community. The problem comes when there aren't any countervailing voices to show, because nothing's cost-free. Even with Young's arguments, I believe, you know, the public, you know, Young is particularly active now in the information superhighway, and there are real, genuine public interest concerns about access for people of all income levels to this new information age. And that's something that he's well aware of, and I think he has a good position on, but, you know, civil liberties groups or other organizations might have a different take on. And really, the policy marketplace needs to hear from everybody, and the problems occur when some voices aren't heard because they can't compete with the level of money that the other side has, or access, or they're just not organized.
Hmm. So there should always be this fervor of ideas contesting each other, and that's our protection.
That's the American way of doing it, yeah.
That's great. Max Holland, thank you so much for being with us again on Dialogue. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, George.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Max Holland, contributing editor of The Nation and The Wilson Quarterly. I am George Liston, CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Assistant producer is Dennis Saunier, and our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by APR, American Public Radio, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Radio Smithsonian. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For a cassette copy of this program, or for more information, call the Radio Store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444.
From APR, American Public Radio.